we all go through terrible things in our lives. None of us are going to get away from suffering. And also, suffering exists at every turn. I mean, there are lonely people in that building across from my house that I'm looking at right now. There's suffering everywhere. So what a privilege for any of us to be able to alleviate the suffering of others. And when you go to suffering and do something about it, it gives meaning to the suffering, to the efforts, to your own life.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. Welcome to Species Unite, the podcast where we talk to people who are fighting some of the hardest fights on Earth to stop the unnecessary suffering of animals. I am really excited to share today's conversation. It's with Joanne MacArthur. Joanne's an award-winning photojournalist and the founder of We Animals Media. For 20 years, she's been photographing and bearing witness to our complex relationship with animals. She's worked in over 60 countries in just about every industry you can imagine, including fur farms, factory farms, bear biofarms, zoos, rodeos, marine parks, with the mission to make the lives of these invisible animals visible. She's also co-founder of the Unbound Project and the author of two books, We Animals and Captive. And she was the subject of Liz Marshall's acclaimed documentary, The Ghost in Our Machine.
I think we all grow up with a lot of animals. We may just not be seeing them. I mean, I was always seeing the squirrels and the wildlife in my neighborhood in Ottawa. Also, I would always beg my parents for animals that I could have in the house, you know, gerbils, hamsters, birds. I was always attracted to the, you know, other species and very, very curious about them. So I did grow up with them, had a lot of empathy. Like there was a dog that lived in a backyard outside in the cold Canadian winter year round, and they allowed me to go over there and walk the dog. Like I'd knock on the neighbor's door and I'm like, can I play with your dog? Can I walk your dog? Because the dog was just crying and barking all the time. I couldn't just sit there. Well, I mean, I guess that is by extension how I live my life. It's like, I can't just sit there. Once you know something, you can't unknow it. You can't unsee it. And I think that's definitely one of the drivers for me is, you know, creating change, helping others.
I love the story about the monkey in Ecuador from many years ago when you first decided that taking photographs of these animals was what you were going to do. Could you just tell us that story?
Yeah, I was already completely obsessed with photography and photographing everything. I was traveling as a tourist and I came across this monkey who was chained up to a window and he was trained to pick pockets and like, you know, really poorly. Like I'm sure he never got anything, but like he would go through people's stuff as they came by and people would stop and take pictures. So there was a crowd around this window and people were taking pictures. I was taking pictures. They were taking pictures and they were laughing at the monkey. They were taking pictures because it was funny and entertaining and these sort of shallow reasons. And I was taking pictures because I was like, this is really sad. This is a problem. Maybe I can do something with these images. Maybe I can show someone this image and, you know, help the monkey. I was like, oh, well, I think that my opinion of this situation is probably an important one, at least to the monkey. And I'd like to share that opinion through photography.
And was that the moment, the I'm going to change everything right now, this is my life kind of moment? Or was there more of an unfolding to it?
It definitely unfolded, but it was a moment because photographers are always looking for their unique story that they can shoot. And I realized, like, wow, there aren't a lot of people photographing animals from their perspective as much as possible, or a perspective of empathy. We see a lot of wildlife photography in the world. It has often and traditionally been for the purpose of pleasing us and entertaining us. It doesn't help the animal. And we see a lot of pet photography, companion animals, but then these invisible animals, as I call them, and sometimes they're in plain view, like the macaque who was chained up. They're animals who have no agency. We've taken their autonomy away from them. We use them for our entertainment, food, fashion. We use them for medical research, all sorts of things. And these animals have no representation in the media. We don't care about pigs and chickens because we eat them. We don't care about mink because we wear them. And I was like, okay, I have my work cut out for me. I'm going to do this. And it's been over 20 years now.
And then you started going into these situations where animals are exploited and abused in so many industries. But how did you actually go about that? How did that work?
In order to expose the lives of these animals, it does require a lot of investigative work, a lot of digging, and a lot of trespassing, unfortunately. But someone like me who wants to expose things as they are would not be welcome at a factory farm. Or if I were, it might be cleaned up, you know, and I'd only be shown like a few of the animals. Or for example, they take all the dead hens out of the cages at a laying facility, that kind of thing. So it is important when you're doing investigative work to go and see things as they are.
And so for a lot of it, you've had to go undercover or sneak in to these places.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that easier to do like when you started, especially in North America, and compared to now where it's kind of like getting into Fort Knox, getting into a factory farm?
Right. That's a good question. Things have changed tremendously even in the last 10 years. It's just harder to access these places. I don't even attempt in the US because of issues like the, well, issues, laws like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So I can be charged for terrorism, for going on a property, even for photographing a animal industrial complex from public property, from the road. Yeah, I mean, that's so wrong. So what exactly are they trying to protect there, right? I mean, this is industry being protected by corporate money and the government, and these places should have glass walls so that we can know what's going on in there.
Especially, it's what people are eating. Let's go back to just when you first decided, okay, I'm doing We Animals originally, the first version of We Animals.
Yeah, well, you know, it was around the time I was photographing that macaque. We are all animals and we forget that. Or we don't even know it. We don't even realize
it. No, we don't anymore.
Yeah, we are all animals. And, you know, we all go back to the same ancestors and we are all sentient, intelligent, complex in beautifully different ways. And so that's why the project is called We Animals.
And for many years, it was pretty much you.
Yeah, it was me with a camera and my insatiable determination to uncover stories and see things and share that with the world.
So tell us a little bit. I mean, you would just, okay, now I'm going to Asia. Now I'm going to South America. I mean, you literally were just went after every issue that you heard of. Like, how did that work?
Yeah, and people probably wonder, like, oh, is she independently wealthy? Which I'm not, but I'm a commercial photographer. And at the time, I was shooting weddings and events and food and all this. And so my commercial money would pay for the good stuff, as I call it, the documentary work, which does not pay. It does now, but it didn't then. I would find out about, you know, bear bile farming in Asia. Well, what the hell is that? Okay, I have to go and see that for myself and document it. Or, you know, there are millions and millions of mink in Scandinavia. I found that every country that I go to, there are terrible things happening. And we like to point our finger. That happens there. That doesn't happen in my country. People here in Canada, we think, oh, well, we're so great. You know, like, we couldn't possibly do that, but we have terrible transport laws. We have cetaceans in captivity and we club baby seals.
Yes.
Hello.
Yeah. Yes. And you have Canada Goose.
And we have Canada Goose. Oh my gosh.
I hear that a lot because I've talked a lot about the dog meat trade and people want to go after the people as opposed to the activity. And we're not doing much better anywhere else. I mean, there's as much torture going on in our slaughterhouses and factory farms as there are. We hide it better.
And you touched on something there. I think it's really important to expose industries. I'm not interested in exposing people, calling out names. People have all sorts of reasons for working in these industries, either, you know, because it's tradition or it's the only job that they can get. Even with Gandhi, he, you know, in his activism, he's like, you know, we're not going after the Brits, we're going after imperialism. We're trying to take down a system. And that's what I'm trying to do with my animal work.
I was thinking about this week when I was re-going through a lot of your world was, I don't think many people have seen as much in as many places as you. You literally are everywhere. Like, how many countries have you worked in?
About 60.
Yeah. and in every industry. I'm sure you get asked often, is like, where's the worst place or where's the best place? But it's all bad industry.
It's all bad. And the industries are, I don't know if you can say streamlining, but let's say, for example, broiler facilities, and a broiler chicken is the industrial term for a meat chicken. And so whether I'm in Sweden or Australia or Nepal, the systems are looking more and more identical. The watering systems, the feeding systems, the buildings, just these huge, massive sheds that are often windowless.
I saw the short film on your website about the monkeys in Cambodia who've been taken and end up being used in U.S. testing labs. And this connection between countries and the use of animals and the exploitation and abuse. Have you seen in all your years of doing this, is this something that's growing, this connection?
More than ever, the trade of animals is more international than ever, and the transport of animals as well. We're seeing ships with 20 to 30,000 cattle.
Will you tell us what that means and what happens on these ships and how that works?
Yeah. So speaking of the connectivity of all this, so sheep and cows are raised in Australia, and then they are put on trucks, which go to ships, and then they're loaded onto ships to go to places like the Middle East, where they want to have fresh animals. They don't want the animals killed in Australia and then sent over frozen. They want fresh meat, and so that they can kill it halal, for example. And so the journey by sea, and we don't know just how bad it is for animals, by the way, with seasickness. I mean, even for us, it's hard for us to get our sea legs. Animals are not meant for the sea. So imagine being on a 3-week journey to somewhere equally or more hot, and then being loaded onto trucks, and then going to feedlots and going to slaughterhouses. There are so many aspects to the lives of animals that remain completely invisible. I use that word a lot. If we think at all of the animal on our plate, we might have some sanitized idea of what their lives looked like without any consideration for the number of events they went through, from being separated from friends and family, tattooed, tagged, cut, traumatized, transported. It's really something. And that's my job, is to uncover all of these sides and facets of their lives.
There's so many things about you doing your job that just astonish me, that I just think it's so incredible. One is your resilience. I've talked to a lot of people who've worked undercover, and a lot of people will tell you, you know, I couldn't do it for more than 2 years. I couldn't do it for more than 3 years because it's so traumatic.
Yeah.
And you've been doing it for close to 20.
Yeah, the hardcore stuff has been just over a decade. But yeah, I've been doing animal work for 20 years. People are really curious about my resilience, and I don't have a quick answer for that other than seeing that the images affect people and do create change is probably all of what I need to continue. If no one was seeing the work, I would stop. But there's a demand for the work. And that's why I'm speaking globally now at all sorts of conferences and with all sorts of age groups. And media is covering these stories a lot more than they ever used to as well. For example, The Guardian has a series called Animals Farmed. I mean, that's incredible. And why would I stop now? I mean, I'm really, really energized.
And also, when you started, it was hard to get your stuff looked at and published and just seen by people compared to now too, right?
Yes, there's a huge difference between then and now. I will also say that my work wasn't as good then. You know, I'm a much better photographer now, so the work is more compelling now. However, definitely doors were closed to me a lot more. And also, I identified a lot more as an activist. I still am an activist. People can see that. But I think I led with that more, which definitely closes a lot of doors in the media. I mean, fully aware of that. They want people who are more objective and, you know, not bleeding heart sentimentalists, especially with regards to animals.
But that, it's shifted too in terms of people are more willing, I think, to look at animals now.
I mean, now is the time to be involved in this because there are so many pieces of the puzzle being put into place on the legal side of things. Like, we're banning cetaceans in captivity. We are getting hens out of constrictive cages, 10, 20, 30 to a cage and all this. We're not seeing that anymore. So the legal side of things is changing. Policy is changing. Science is changing. Ethology is now, you know, a booming field of people who are studying the behavior of animals, understanding their complexity and sentience. And so the more we know about their intellects, their intelligence, the more like we can't treat them the way we do. And so it's a historical time to be doing this work, to be contributing. And definitely we are on the right side of history. We are on the more compassionate and meaningful side of history. So I'm not leaving.
I hope not. No, I don't want you to leave.
I'm amazed at how you've been able to stay. And I've heard you say before, you know, the hardest part when you're in these situations, whether it's factory farm or fur farm, is when you do leave the animals.
Yeah.
And that they stay.
Yeah. It's so unfair. It's so unfair. And I don't know if I could ever really put into words just how hard it is to be in there, one of the only people in these places that will ever care for those individuals. And to look at them and to want to capture a little bit of their experience and look in their eyes and then just to go on to the next cage or the next stall.
Earlier this week, I watched Ghost in Our Machine.
Oh.
Lismore. I saw it a couple years ago, but I just to remember it, which it's a documentary about Joanne and her work made by Liz Marshall. And it's incredible. But what really stuck out for me, knowing I was coming to talk to you, one thing is your gentleness.
Mm.
You're just like this gentle, like, compassionate, vibrant soul. That's how you are now. That's how you are in the film. That's how you are in talks I've seen you give. And your work is so badass and tough. But the reason I'm mentioning this is two things. Watching that film again, I was looking at it differently in the sense of when you are with those animals, they soften. There's a softness, even in the fur farms, the eyes soften, where I'm sure human presence makes them normally terrified.
Yeah. You're right. You're right. I think the humans that they're used to having around don't look at them, don't see them. They're not trying to see them. They're just going in there trying to vaccinate them or take their babies away or usher them from one crate to the next and or kill them. And so you see from even the first weeks of their lives, they learn to be afraid of us. I would never say like I have some magic, some magic relationship between them and I, but what I do is, yeah, there's a softness. I go in and I'm trying to make myself small and quiet and I stand in front of them and I want to photograph them and their experience. So I take a bit of time and I stay there as much as I can, and the fear quickly turns to curiosity. You see that with pigs, hens, mink. Yeah. And I can't help but sort of speak quietly under my breath to them. I just literally can't help it. I do it every time. Even last week at the Save Vigil in LA, looking in the trucks and putting my lens in the trucks and facing these animals as in their last moments as they're going to slaughter, I can't help but, you know, say under my breath, I'm sorry. I don't know how to stop doing that. Like I don't think it helps them, but I can't seem to help myself. Do they sense compassion and something different? Certainly they do from people who care.
Well, and energy kind of plays a much bigger role for them than us because they're so much more
right.
open to it.
Yeah.
And so when some good energy walks into the room, I'm sure they can feel it in a different way.
I wonder what they would say to us if we had a common language. And in fact, if we did have a common language, it would be much harder for us to kill them and treat them this way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it comes out in your images. They're haunting. They're absolutely stunning. So the reason I found out like that you even exist, it was shortly after We Animals, the book, came out. And I saw it somewhere on some website or someone talking about it, but I had never heard of you, but it had just come out. So I ordered it. And then, and I was like, who is this woman? I love her.
Yeah.
And later I bought Captive. And so they're both on my coffee table still. And so when people come over who are kind of unsuspecting, they'll sit on my couch and they're waiting for me. They're on the top of the other books. So they'll immediately pick up one or the other. And they're not expecting to see, you know, your haunting, incredible photos of these animals in really hard situations. And I see the power of it. It happens quite a bit.
And that's what coffee table books are for.
Exactly.
They're meant to be on your coffee table for people to open. So that's good. Thanks.
They're I mean, the power and the images, they are haunting and they're heartbreaking and they're so important. And I do think you do capture something that I just don't think a lot of people could capture in the same way. I mean, there's something, there's such a connection happening in so many, you can feel it like in your images.
Yeah, I think I want the urgency to translate. I want the real messed upness to translate. I want the industrialization to come through. And at the center of all that is this little individual looking at you. And when they look at us, they always have questions in their eyes. I mean, that's how it goes. We have all the answers and they have all the questions. Like, who are you? What are you going to do to me? Like, that's always what's in their eyes. Like, what is next? Don't harm me. Are you going to harm me? It's awful. Imagine living that way. Yeah.
I can't. And have you had moments where you're like, I just can't do this anymore? Or no?
That has not crossed my mind.
That's good. But it's had to have been, I mean, hard is to say the least. It's traumatic.
Yeah, but we all go through terrible things in our lives. None of us are going to get away from suffering. And also, suffering exists at every turn. I mean, there are lonely people in that building across from my house that I'm looking at right now. There's suffering everywhere. So what a privilege for any of us to be able to alleviate the suffering of others. And when you go to suffering and do something about it, it gives meaning to yeah. to the suffering, to the effort, to your own life.
In terms of taking care of yourself through this, because you're in so many situations that are
don't
so
assume
severe.
I take care of myself so well.
Well, you look like it. And you seem like it. You seem pretty healthy.
Yeah.
No, but going in, you know, time after time, did you have to like learn self-care?
I did. I found myself sort of slipping into a bit of depression a few years ago. And I was also, I had therapy for PTSD as a result of just bearing witness to so much suffering, and it can incapacitate you a little bit. And I found that my thoughts were getting a lot darker, and I'm a very happy and up type of person. So I realized there was a problem happening. And so I had therapy, and I had to train my brain to just not live in the darkness that I know about worldwide. Just because it exists doesn't mean I have to be there. And we often think as animal activists that we should feel everything that they're feeling and suffer along with them. And that does have its place, but that's not where I want to live. And that's not, I don't think, where we should live, because we will burn out. And you mentioned that other investigators and people in general involved in activism, they'll come in and out of it fairly quickly because it's so painful and it's so hard and progress seems really slow. And so we need to focus on the good and on change and on progress. And that's what I do.
And you keep expanding.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the expansion? Will you talk about the Unbound Project?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Speaking of change and progress, that's a great segue. Everywhere I went, I saw that it was women at the front lines of animal advocacy. And I was like, am I imagining that? Am I projecting? Because, you know, I'm a woman and a feminist and all this. But no, I did some research, and it turns out that women do lead the movement as high as 60 to 80% in Europe and North America. And I was like, wow, okay, well, men are often in positions of leadership in the movement. And we see that everywhere in the world. And so let's do a project that celebrates women trailblazers and all the inspiring women out there. And so the Unbound Project now features almost 60 women worldwide who are pioneers and trailblazers, but also the women who are toiling away in obscurity, who are like, you know, the frontliners who answer the emergency calls at 3 a.m. and go off in the animal ambulance. I love this project, and it's a nice reprieve for me. It's great balm for my heart, honestly, to do this project. But also, I am motivated and inspired by mentors and heroes, and they are in part why I have the life that I have. Like, I looked up to people like Jane Goodall. I was like, oh, look at her go. Okay, I want a life like that. And so I want to give that to other people. I want people to see the women in the Unbound Project and be like, oh, I didn't know you could be an animal rights lawyer. I didn't know you could be a neuroscientist. And, you know, with your primary position as advocating for animals, getting animals out of labs, like anything that you want to do in this world, you can use that in the service of others. And that's what the Unbound Project is.
It's really cool. And then your latest project and huge expansion on everything you do is We Animals Media.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's amplifying the stories that we're telling. And I say we now because what was once me with the camera is me with a team of six and more contributors to We Animals Media. So we have director of operations and communications and social media people and contributors now. I've been watching very closely over recent years, who's doing really strong work in this realm, who's doing really good investigative work, who's focusing on the invisible animals as well. Let's bring them in, let's make a little agency and make films and let's write and let's take photos and do more stories. And so wonderfully, we have grants for that. And we're also building up the development side of things because, of course, this has to be sustainable. So there's a lot on my plate now. I used to be, you know, Joe the photographer, and now I'm like Joe the founder and manager. And
it's a lot of work. It's also got to be nice to have this kind of community right here around you, because it's lonely, hard work when you're out there for years going in places, right?
Yeah. Well, interesting that you say that, because when I'm going into places, it's always with a team, whether they're with a grassroots NGO or, you know, a security team and other people who are invested. And it's funny because you really bond when you do work like that really hardcore, awful work. And so I feel like I have families all around the world, these little investigative families. And so it's not lonely in that regard, but certainly it's really nice to have a team now that we can build together. And I'm not the only one making decisions and all the banter that goes, you know, with working with a team every day. But they're such lovely, passionate people. I feel really lucky.
You said you're speaking now to a lot more.
Oh, tons more. So in the last few years, we have the We Animals Humane Education Program. So I'm in schools speaking with kids and doing age-appropriate talks.
How old are the kids?
The youngest has been grade 2.
What are you telling them? I'm just curious, what are you allowed to say?
It's funny because I tend to tell the same stories between the grade 2s and every other age group, but in a different way. And what I find with kids is that, of course, we know that they're very curious, that generally they love animals, and they want to hear secrets. They are fascinated when they learn something that was hidden to them.
What, for example?
Like dairy, for example. So how many of you have met a cow? And how long do you think a cow can live? And the dairy industry will say that a cow will live to 6 years old. Well, that's when they're killed. That's when they are spent. And so that is incorrect. So I was like, you know, and sometimes the dairy industry, especially here in Canada, goes into schools to, you know, talk about cows, talk about milk and why we should drink milk. And one time I went in about a week after a dairy rep was there, and I knew that. And I was like, okay, guys, how long can a cow live? And they're like, 6. I was like, well, actually, I've met cows who are 32 and they actually can live really long. And they're like, no way, you know, and you know, did you know that, you know, babies are taken away from their mothers so that we can drink the milk and we don't even have to drink the milk? I'm like, no way. And then, of course, all the talks are along with a slideshow. So they get to see the individuals I'm talking about and see a process. And, you know, with the young kids, I certainly don't show anything that's really gory or traumatizing. It's, you know, it's in the storytelling.
And then older kids.
Yeah, a lot of colleges, a lot of photo conferences now, law conferences. I don't know why the lawyers keep inviting me around so much.
Really?
I guess because, like, I'm telling the stories of the individuals that they're representing.
Obviously, you're doing a million things, but where do you go next?
What's next is staying home for a little bit and working with the team. But I have a third book coming, and this time it's not just my work. I'm the co-editor with a wonderful editor named Keith Wilson. And so again, I mentioned I've been looking very closely at who's doing good work. We have invited about a dozen photographers to contribute to this book. The working title is Animals in the Anthropocene. This is a book, an unapologetic historical tome of a book that is meant to house images that just get swept by on social media or that won't be published in the mainstream because they're so hardcore. This isn't a book with a happy ending.
Oh, that's
incredible.
This
is an indictment. This is proof of what we have done. And I mean, this is going to be a big 5-pound book. It'll have hundreds of images. And I was inspired to do this by a war photographer named James Noctway. And in 1999, he published a book called Inferno. And it was just this huge indictment of civil war and famine and genocide and all these things that we cause that he has photographed over decades. And it's all in one book. And he's like, look at this. This is what we have done. And so that is a model definitely for this book, but for animals.
So you're still in the process of putting it together now?
We are at the collecting and editing stage. Yeah. My editor, Keith, is in London, and it has been such a pleasure spending days and days with him at the Royal Geographical Society, where we work in the office there, and just poring over images and, yeah, piecing together the horrors and the stories.
I can't wait for this book.
Weird, eh? That we can't wait. Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it's not a book that everyone's going to want, but it's nevertheless an important book. It's historical, it's a discussion piece, and it's going to be beautiful in all of its realness and horror.
And I would think it's important. It's one of those books that I would hope that however many years from now, people look back.
Yes.
And are shocked in a different way than people now would be shocked that this ever existed in the first place.
Exactly. Yeah, well said. I mean, it's going to be a story of what was once and what should never again be.
And one more question for
you. Yeah.
So since you've been doing this 20 years, and it's probably very hard to know because it's been your whole life and you've been so in it, having this exposure and this kind of fight in you and being literally one of the people who, not very many people at the time, were just constantly saying, look here, look at this, look at this. And now finally people are looking a lot more than they were.
Yeah.
How has that informed kind of who you are?
Well, I've learned that I can tolerate a lot of suffering, and people who suffer do learn that, right? When you lose someone, when you go through illnesses, we think we can't handle and manage these things, but a lot of us can. We're alive. We do. We, you know, physically get through it, and we can learn from it, and we can use it to be in the present, to be grateful, to take action. And I think that is also why I can keep going.
Yeah.
And by extension, we are, I want to say, like, we don't look at animal suffering because we're afraid of suffering. We're also afraid of facing our complicity in suffering. So it really is a double whammy. Like, people just don't want to go there. But it feels bad, but you can do something with that. That is, again, talking about the point of suffering and the meaning of suffering. You can do something with that that is meaningful and that helps others. I've learned that. And I wish for us all to learn that. Yeah.
And so what can people do? How can they help?
Yeah. As with all my talks, especially with the young people, they're like, well, you know, you take pictures. Well, what can I do? I'm just 12, or, you know, I'm just whatever age they are. You can use your skills to make the world a better place, whether you're into law or art, whatever you're into. We're at a point in history where we all need to be turning our efforts towards helping others, whether it's animals, humans, the environment. It's an emergency, as we know. So I tell people to, like, employ your skills in the service of others and whatever makes you joyful. We can also stop using animals. That is something very immediate that we can all do. We can reduce or not use animals. And it's an empowering thing. People think that it's going to feel like a sacrifice to them. But I mean, especially in the plant-based world now, I mean, I love a big juicy burger, you know, and I can get that down the street at A&W now. And, you know, it's so we can make personal changes. We can make change our consumer habits. So that's like the number one easiest thing we can all do.
How can people get behind We Animals Media?
We can't do any of this without the financial support coming in. We have an archive, the We Animals Archive, and there are over 12,000 images there that people can use for their own animal advocacy work, and they're free. And again, that's been an interesting business model because most photographers need to sell their images to support their work. But I was like, nope, again, like, this always comes back to being in the service of animals. So how do we make everything available for free so that the images get out there? Through donations and through grants. And so that's a big part of the puzzle for us. And sharing our work. Yeah, you can follow We Animals Media, and we put out stories all the time, and just help us get those images out there.
Thank you, Joanne. This was fantastic.
Thanks for helping me share my work.
Yeah.
Such a pleasure speaking with you.
You too.
If you would like to learn more about Joanne and We Animals Media, spend some time on their website. It's weanimalsmedia.org. You can spend hours on there. There's short films and photo galleries that will change you, they'll inspire you, and hopefully spur you into action. We also have links to Joanne's work on our website, which is speciesunite.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And we're also on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I'd like to thank everyone who made today's episode possible, including Gary Knudsen, Natalie Martin, Allison Berenger, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.